Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. Robbie Arnott has written three novels, Flames, 2018, and The Rain Heron, 2020, won and were shortlisted for numerous awards. His third novel, Limber Lost, was his first historical novel and was longlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023. Okay, so Robert Geoffrey Charles Arnott, welcome to Imagining the Past.
Thank you very much. How do you know my full name?
It's in your email.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you've given yourself away.
Yeah, normally I like to spring it on people, but I feel quite glad to have been rumbled.
So, what was the first vision you had of yourself as an author?
Oh, God. I never had a vision of myself as an author at all. I've always just been a reader more than anything. And so I came to writing as a kid and as a teenager because it felt like the most normal thing to do when you love reading that much. I started wanting to write my own sort of story to novels. I'm really bad at thinking ahead. I can only ever hold 6 weeks of time in ahead, so 3 weeks ahead and 3 weeks behind. Anything else, I'm just hopeless. So any vision I have of myself as an author is never anything more than 3 weeks from now. And I think it kind of works out. If you don't really dream too far ahead, you just focus on what you're doing and then let the rest of it take care of itself. That's been my approach so far.
We recently got hopelessly lost in Limber Lost territory up on the Tamar Valley there. So what was the first ideas you had around the novel of Limber Lost?
It was really based on my grandfather's life. He grew up in the West Tamar Valley on an orchard, and he'd always tell us these stories about his childhood that seemed to him completely mundane and normal and just funny little yarns, and to me always felt almost mythic and incredible and like stories from another world because they're so different to my childhood in the 90s.
So where did you grow up in Tasmania?
I grew up in Launceston and the Tamar Valley.
So. Right. So you did spend quite a bit of time up around there. It's up around Beaconsfield, yeah?
Yeah, near Beaconsfield. His orchard was just in the Sidmouth and Rowella, just outside of Beaconsfield. And I spent a lot of childhood there and on the beaches around the mouth of the Tamar. It's where all my family are from. So, yeah, a lot of spent time childhood there and then also in the, you know, completely suburbs of Launceston.
Right, and is Limber Lost your first historical fiction?
Yeah, I guess so. I've had two novels before this, but they're a bit more magical realist or mythical and not specifically historical in any way, although there were historical elements to my first novel, Flames. But yeah, I'm probably going to be not a great guest for this podcast because I never really conceived of it as a historical novel. I guess it is. I'm not trying to deny that. But it's just, genre is just not something I really think about very often. Like, focus on the story I'm trying to tell or what I'm trying to convey or the feeling I want to get across, and whatever comes out, comes out. And in this case, it was, historical Australiana sort of novel.
So, I mean, I guess that's quite a different take on it because most historical fiction writers will tell you how mired they are in research. So did you feel like you had to do some research to write this, or was it all just based on your family stories?
Look, I did do some research. But I'm not going to pretend that I did the level of detail of years in a library that many historical fiction novelists will do. It was always to make sure I'm getting these facts right in a way so that a reader won't trip up, because something will be so factually incorrect that it's annoying. You know, feeling when something's just so wrong, it takes you out of the story. I really wanted to avoid that. But beyond that, I didn't want to weigh it down with detail. I was really conscious of having all this research, doing all this research and finding out all this stuff, and then feeling like I need to put it in the book because I spent so much time on it. I know that I would do that. That would be something I would tend towards doing. So I tried to kind of head off my own tendencies by not doing any more research than I felt I needed to. And I wanted to, because a lot of the reason I felt I didn't need to do so much research is because it all came from stories my grandfather used to tell me, and I recorded a lot of those on my phone before he died. And I tried to focus on his vision of the world and his memories of it rather than a detail-rich version of it that might be picked up from a historical text.
So I guess that brings us to another point, which is quite interesting about Limberlost, is that if you have written it from your family's history, did you run into some kind of moral and ethical dilemmas with that? I would imagine it would be quite hard to do that. You could end up stepping on a few toes if you weren't careful.
Yeah, especially if you know my family too. big problems there. But no, it was okay. I decided early on that I wanted to have a novel that recreated or told a lot of my grandfather's experiences and memories, and that was emblematic of the life he lives. But I never sought to recreate his character. So because a lot of characters in the novel who are analogous to people from real life, but in personality and behavior, they're all very different. They experience a lot of the same things, but it's very obvious to anyone in my family or anyone who would know them, they're not that person. And that's essentially how I got around it. If anyone's writing a historic novel based on the family, that really works for me, by saying, you know, I wanted to capture the experience and capture the time without capturing the individual. Because I was never interested in trying to write about my grandfather as an individual. I never thought I'd be able to do that anyway. I didn't really want to. I just wanted to have more of a picture of some of the things he went through.
Yeah, I guess that kind of leads to my next question, which is, yeah, I think we all kind of think we lead these absolutely fabulous lives, but most of them are pretty kind of drear. So in kneading your family kind of folklore into a novel, did you, you know, what kind of departures did you kind of confront to make it into a novel, you know, into a compelling novel?
I think a lot of it was around timing, condensing some periods and stretching some others out, bringing some climactic experiences closer or further away from other ones, and introducing people's relationships to them in a way that had that feel more powerful on the page than ever happened in real life. I didn't have to do too much. And that was kind of the point of the book in some ways, is I wanted to show that people can have completely ordinary lives that are internally extraordinary. And I think we all feel that, where we might be living what is externally looking like a very mundane existence, but we're going through profound emotional experiences all the time. I wanted that to be quite present. I mean, you could say in the book there's just a boy who's restoring an old boat and not really doing much else all summer. But hopefully it's clear in the book that to Ned, the main character of the book, this is a profound experience for him, and it's changing him as he's going about it and altering his view of himself and his view of the world. And that's kind of what I wanted to get across, is we can be living what seems like an ordinary life, but inside we're exploding all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you've hinted here at the timeline of the story, because the first three chapters kind of pole vault around, you know, 20 years. So it's quite a big brace of time you're moving around there. The bulk of the novel sets into the period around Ned being around 15, although it does kind of dart off into other periods. What do you think this kind of moving the timeline around kind of added to the novel? And at what stage of the writing process did you start kind of shuffling the time?
I think I intended to write it that way always from the beginning. I wanted novel to roughly 50% to be set across this one summer of Ned's life, and then every second chapter to switch to another period of his life where he's older. And we can just kind of gently see how that one summer comes to shape the rest of him and his whole life. So I wanted to get this kind of, have my cake and eat it too. I wanted to show the whole experience of Ned's life in these kind of flash forwards while anchoring them to this one really pivotal season. I thought it might be a neat storytelling technique, and I thought it might work. I don't know if it works, but I thought it would be a kind of a way to do it. And I didn't really think too hard about it beyond that, because if I did, then I would have gotten this paragraph done.
So just turning to your craft a bit for a while, tell us about your first draft. Do you kind of plan it out, or do you just kind of wing it as you go?
Yeah, I've only recently realized that people think about craft a lot. Sorry, not to sound blasé. I hadn't realized that other people did things differently. I got really intimidated when people started telling me they were on their 27th draft of a novel, because I always feel like I only ever had one or two. Obsess over the sentences and paragraphs and rhythm and commas and reading it out loud and over and over and over again. It takes me a very, very long time to get me to be happy with a page. So it's very much kind of two steps forward, three steps back, sort of dogged style of writing.
I guess the notion of a draft has kind of deteriorated with the advent of using word processing to write, because you can just keep on writing over the top of it. Whereas if you were, writing on a typewriter or by hand, there would be a certain point where you would have to think, oh, well, I just have to start typing this again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're totally right. And I'd take a lot of notes, physical notes in a handbook or a notebook that I carry these notebooks around, and I'm always making kind of barely legible notes. So I wouldn't really call it like composition. And then in a Word document, I'm, as you say, going over it, re-editing it as I'm going. So generally by the time the book is like in a bound manuscript form, it's probably had three major edits. But apart from that, it's just kind of just the one document I've just sweated over. I never just sit down and write something from start to finish and then come back and look at it again, because I wouldn't be able to sleep at night, because I just would think everything I worked on today needs to be fixed. It's all rubbish. I'm not saying that's healthy or productive. It just is the way I have somehow ended up doing it.
So do you like a first draft, or is it painful for you?
I quite enjoy it. I do this because I like it, and I don't know any other way. I really do enjoy the process of writing. By the last 20%, I generally start to lose my mind and go a bit crazy. And I think other writers will tell you this. You're trying to hold your head at the same time. And maybe some people are smart enough to do that. I'm certainly not. So everything starts to fall apart and I go a bit manic. And it's probably not healthy for me or anyone around me. But the first 80% is a lot of fun.
How many words do you aim for in a writing session generally? Some people only aim for 500 a day and things.
Yeah, I don't really ever think about that. It's as much as I can get done that feels like is working. And I've never really been a full-time writer. I've had day jobs and stuff, and I'm now kind of just transitioning into just being a writer, but I also have an 18-month-old daughter, so spending a lot of time with her. So I've never really had like a 9-to-5 sit down and write 1,000 words a day or anything. It's kind of in the gaps between trying to have a professional job and be a husband and now a father and a friend and try not to be too late to cricket training. And generally, if I can get somewhere between, I don't know, I'll invent a number, 800 words, that sounds like a good writing session.
So do you, you've kind of hinted at this, but it's kind of stands in the kind of antithesis to the way I used to work, was that I felt like I needed to get a whole draft down before I went back and started revising, because it felt like a real change of gear to go back and start revising and redrafting. You actually really work on a small part and get that kind of sorted before you move on?
Yeah. And that I do. I will come back and then look at it again in context of the whole, like very, very focused another time. But I won't really move on from the writing of a piece or a section, a chapter or a page, I'm pretty with it. I probably won't be 100% happy, but I'll be happy enough that I feel I can move forward with the story or the chapter with confidence. Because if there's even a slight inkling to me that I might need to, that I know what to do in order to fix it, I have to go back and do that. Yeah, it's probably, I don't think anyone would recommend doing it like that, but.
I've been thinking a lot lately about naming of characters because, you know, I think it's a really powerful tool. And I kind of think that sometimes authors really forget about how powerful names are. So I'm just wondering what Ned West reveals about his character for us.
Nothing so much in the is that I thought it fitted the time and the character. I wanted to have a short clipped name because that's the men of that generation I knew, much older than me, how they referred to each other. And I think if you think back, or if, particularly regional Australia, not necessarily just Tasmania, no one was ever called by their actual name. Even if someone's name was Thomas, at best he'd be called Tom, but there'd be some variation on that that everyone knew him by. Both my grandfather this book is about, was named Charles, but no one ever called him Charles. Everyone called him Bruce. And that was completely...
They seem related.
Yeah, his name was Bruce. And even his grandchildren and children called him Bruce. I only ever called him Bruce. And my other grandfather was named Rex, but I found out when I was about 20 that his real name was Adrian. So I kind of wanted to have this idea of just this short, clipped, easy name that was emblematic of that time. And I think the last name West was just a bit of an indulgence on my part because it felt romantic.
The title Limberlost is a lovely word, and I think it really very easily evokes the whole thing of a coming-of-age novel. So how did you kind of arrive at that?
Well, that was a gift. That was really easy. It's taken from the title A Girl of the Limberlost by Jean Stratton Porter, which is a very famous novel from the 1910s from America. And she wrote a series of Limberlost books, and they're essentially the Harry Potter of their time. Very, very popular, still well-known today and to some people. But the orchard that my grandfather grew up on actually was called Limberlost in real life. There's still parts of it still. Some of it mostly operate as a dairy now. Other parts have been carved off into vineyards. But it was named that because my great-grandmother, when they bought the property, arrived there, and her favourite book was A Girl of the Limberlost, and there was a kind of great forest there. And it reminded her of the forest she'd encountered in the pages of this book. That's how they came to the name for their orchard, which 100 years later came to be the name of the book, essentially about their lives. I thought it was a nice tribute to them.
Yeah, no, it's just such a beautiful word with, for me, it just kind of evoked this lost youth, you know, this lost limberness of youth. And, you know, Ned telling the story from an older age and looking back, he was kind of admitting he'd lost that limberness of youth that he had at 15.
Yeah, I love the word. I never tried to, because it does feel quite evocative to me, I very deliberately tried not to think too hard about it because I would overanalyze it. But yeah, I feel lucky that it's such a kind of almost poetical, rhythmical word came along and was almost given to me in a way.
Yeah.
And I claim that I came up with something in a rather pretentious manner.
When you're redrafting, do you kind of think about your reader and about, you know, entertaining them and continually engaging them, or do you feel like you've already done that when you've been drafting?
I guess I think about that sort of thing every process of it, the whole time, because I'm kind of drafting and I'm writing and writing as I'm drafting. It all bleeds into each other. I don't so much think about, you know, trying to entertain or shock or whatever to a reader like that. My main philosophy with it is that I have a contract with the reader. If they've gone and got a book from a library or spent $10 to download it or $32.99 or $24.99 in a bookshop and then are spending at least, you know, 3 or 4 hours of their life with it, I just like to think that I had a bit of an obligation to them to do the best thing I possibly can with as much rigor as possible. It helps keeps me focused on the work. Because if someone's giving that X amount of money or that amount of their time to something you've created, then I think it's beholden upon you to really try and not let them down. So that's kind of how I envisage a reader. And not so much as, oh, they're going to want this. They're going to, you know, a couple of books sold well last year that had this sort of element to it. So I want to try and make them happy that way. It's more that I think, oh, don't take the foot off the pedal here. Don't go easy on yourself. In case you can't tell, I'm quite an unserious person, except when it comes to my work, and then I'm perhaps far too serious. And I try and be really, really hard on myself, because I think, you know, what if someone has had a really hard week, they're having a fight with their spouse, their kids are being shitty, and I just want to sit down and read a book because they like reading novels. And if they're reading one of mine, I want them to think, oh, this person has really taken care. They've really had a crack. And that's kind of how I try and think about it. Because the people I know who read novels, that's what they're like. They're reading a couple of, you know, for 15 minutes before bed. And I want them to enjoy that time. Or at the very least, feel like they're not wasting it.
Well, reading is such a luxury now with so much stuff bombarding us. But when I'm preparing to do these interviews, I always kind of have a quick flick through the reviews on Goodreads to see what people are kind of feeling.
Oh, and shit.
I noticed with yours, there were a lot of male reviewers, like as astoundingly more than most novels. I mean, most novels that we have with the historical fiction have been written by women. So what I was kind of interested in was, you know, what do you think about that? And does the gender of the author's name attract the gender of the reader? Because it's quite marked.
Yeah. Look, that might be a bit above my pay grade, but I'll have a crack. I'm really pleased that men are reading the book. You know, I like to think I don't you know, write for men or for women or anything like that. I just try and write the best things I can, and I hope anyone encounters it likes it. But it's definitely true that more women in Australia at least read fiction than men. And as data for that, I worked in an independent bookshop for 8 years. I feel like I can be pretty confident.
Well, you've only got to look at a bookshelf in a bookshop.
Yeah. And, you know, when I talk to, well, I'm 34, and when I talk to, if I'm at a barbecue or whatever, or meeting new people or meeting new men at a sports club or something, I'm generally just, they're very surprised that I write novels, and then I have to clarify that they're fiction. And then they're very confused because it's not a podcast or a sports bet account or whatever that a lot of men are doing. I'm not making fun of men of my age and generation. That's just where they're spending their time. So whenever I hear that, you know, men in particular are interested in reading fiction and encountering stories by other people from other people around them, I'm just very pleased because, you know, reading fiction is kind of the great relationship of my life outside of my family, and it's means so much to me, and it always has. And, you know, I think it's anyone can who knows people who read novels that how important it is and what for you.
In some ways, I guess this is a bit of an impossible question, but how do you think growing up in Tasmania kind of informed your writing?
I think quite clearly in just my obsession with writing about landscape. It's one of the benefits of living in Tasmania is no matter where you are, you're never very far from pretty stunning wildernesses and natural places. So at the moment, you know, I was 10 minutes late to this podcast because I forgot it was on and I was going for a bushwalk, which is at the back of my house. Or I could be in the car for 20 minutes and then I'll be in a World Heritage listed reef. I like snorkeling and bushwalking and things like that. So that kind of just influences you, just the way whatever environment you're in influences you. So that's probably been the biggest factor on me is I write about wild places a lot because I've always been surrounded by them and I'm endlessly inspired by them.
I mean, Tasmania for me is a kind of an odd place. Like when I go there, I feel like there's new and exciting things there, but I do feel like a lot of it is preserved in aspic still. Masculinity in Tasmania, I've always found like an odd petri dish, really. When I was growing up there, like in a lot of ways, you know, gender roles had been largely unchallenged at all. And it was, I think that was exemplified with the gay law reform push in the 90s where, you know, people were told to just leave. You know, it was so, that traditional masculine bastion was so firmly entrenched. So I just kind of think, what do you think Limberlost has told us about masculinity that couldn't have been said if the novel had been kind of set outside of Tasmania?
Yeah, that's very fascinating. Everything you've just said then is true, and that's very emblematic of an external kind of masculinity. That it's funny, when people talk about Tasmania, people from I'm going to say, I know people from mainland Australia find it hilarious when we say the mainland, but it's the only way I know how to refer to it. When people went from the mainland, refer to Tasmania as a bit, you know, backward, or it, I feel like they could just be talking about regional Australia, like anywhere outside of Brisbane, Melbourne.
Look,
Sydney.
I think that's true. But when I grew up in the 70s, and it, because it was so isolated then, you know, like to get an international act in Tasmania was, you know, almost unheard of, you know. So, you know, even film, television, all of these kind of mediums were really kind of reduced. So I do feel like from where I grew up anyway, by the time I came to live in Sydney, I noticed, you know, very large differences in the way how masculinity was acted out on a public, in a public way.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I wanted to get across was the Australian experience and the Tasmanian experience of masculinity in that way, and the way it can be quite destructive and toxic, as we call it, is quite well documented. I feel like as a country, we're pretty aware of it, and some people either reject it, but I think most people understand. You can have a look at the domestic violence statistics or read the paper, you can see how destructive it is. So I guess what I wanted to get across in the book was another aspect of masculinity that's much less talked about or celebrated, which is male tenderness in relationships, which I think is still true. That's not to deny any of the problems with masculinity in Australian culture and history, but purely to just expose some of that throughout the novel. The gentleness that I think Australian men often have always felt, but not felt empowered to communicate. Because in the relationship between Ned and his father in the novel, it's, if it was a more cliched book, I suppose there would have been belts being ripped off and people being strapped and a lot more kind of ugliness. But what you have there is people who don't know how to talk to each other, but nevertheless are trying to help each other and trying to express that love in ways that they don't know how.
I thought the relationship with the father was really well drawn, and it really resonated for me in a lot of ways. Like I'd seen those relationships.
Oh, thank you. And well, that's what I wanted to come through, this kind of almost harsh fumbling towards tenderness that a lot of men struggled with. You know, they're in an environment where, you know, getting blackout drunk and hitting their wives is a bit of the norm, but they didn't actually want to do that at all. And again, I'm not trying to say that wasn't an aspect of culture, but there are layers to it. And that's what I wanted to be present through the West Wing novel.
I mean, it goes on with Ned as a 15-year-old. I found him, like, as a 15-year-old, incredibly kind of asexual. And I just kind of wondered what you were doing with that and what that was about, because it's, you know, I mean, my memories of being 15 are pretty hazy now, but it's kind of not how I remember being 15.
Well, I wanted Ned to come across as this character who's really ripped apart by his sense of duty. He's the youngest of a family. His mother has died. His two older brothers are away at war, and his beloved older sister had just come home, but she's not in a very good mood about any of it. And he's got a very distant father for quite valid reasons. And I wanted him to have that sense of repression, because he yearns to break free and to be his own self, but he feels really bound up by a sense of duty to his family and a sense of responsibility. And I wanted that, and I guess if he comes across as a bit asexual for that, it's as a symptom of his repression that he's essentially imposed upon himself. I think it's important throughout the book you realize no one's ever telling him to be more responsible. No one's ever saying to him, you really need to work harder for your family. Everyone pretty much just wishes the best for him. But he pushes that all upon himself. And I think that's also a tendency that is exhibited through masculinity. And so that's kind of how that came out.
Yeah, it was almost to the point where I, you know, there were points where I was trying to decide if he was prepubescent still, and because his way of kind of looking at the world hadn't, you know, he was like he was approaching the cusp, but he hadn't kind of seen over to the other side of puberty.
I mean, there's that element of that too. There's also just the level of which he would have been armed with knowledge and information and the ability to think about whatever impulses or desires he was having. He just wouldn't have been armed with it. Everything he would have learned would have been through church, and he had no mother. So I kind of kept that part of him distant until he grew older. Because if anything, he would have just been confused.
So what are you working on now?
I've got a new book coming out in October. I'm just finishing the draft on that after our discussion about drafting. I'll be working on that this morning. But yeah, that'll be out in October. And yeah, I can't say too much more about it, I don't think. But
is it set in Tasmania?
Well, sort of. It's set in a something that is recognisably Tasmania to some people, I imagine. Yeah, sorry to be opaque like that.
Oh, we'll have to hit the bookshops in October. So,
yeah.
So you were longlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize last year. So I'm just wondering, and there's a slew of other prizes you've been listed for and won. So I'm just wondering what you kind of feel like the role of these literary prizes are.
They've been really wonderful for me. And the best thing they do, apart from, you know, whoever wins getting a great big chunk of cash, obviously always welcome, is elevating the role of books in the public conversation, because it's something for newspapers to report on and media to grab onto. I think that is such an important role of prizes, is that, you know, it gives these media outlets reasons to talk about Australian novels and bring them to the public consciousness. And just a lot of people who, you know, got into the habit of not reading, hearing about a novel that's been shortlisted or longlisted or won an award, and they get a snippet of it and they go, oh, that sounds fascinating, I might head down to the bookstore or the library and check it out. I think that's always been really a massive role in bringing books to a wider audience, because it's a notable thing that gets in the paper. I'm sure there's much more other important structural things going on, but that's the one thing I've always noticed. And it's, yeah, I think it's really helpful and important.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. I'm sorry we dislodged you from a bushwalk, but I'm sure our readers will appreciate it. And thank you again for the novel. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks so much, Greg. And yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.